Live from the Dan Kosky Building on Historical Asylum Hill, this is a show about the history of the death penalty in Connecticut. In the 1600s, you could be hanged for blasphemy, cursing a parent, or man-stealing. In other words, a long weekend. Historian Lawrence Goodhart tracks Connecticut's death penalty from colonial days to the present. Later on the show, the mother of a New Haven murder victim talks about her struggle to be heard. And now he's still fighting that witchcraft arrest from 1709, Colin McEnroe.
It's a long story. We don't have time for it. But today we are going to talk first about the book, The Solemn Sentence of Death, Capital Punishment in Connecticut. The author, Lawrence B. Goodhart, is here. You'll meet him in just a second. I do want to say that later on in the show today, we will talk to Vicki Coward. Her son, Tyler, was murdered in New Haven in 2007. She's actually gradually emerged as an opponent of the death penalty. And she is one of those survivors of murder victims who feel as though they're not being listened to right now. You may have heard a news item on NPR a little bit earlier today about that. So, and by the way, I would really recommend reading the coverage of her case, her son's case, in the New Haven Independent. They've just done an incredible job of covering that. We're going to start, though, with Lawrence B. Goodhart. He's a professor in the Department of History at UConn. The book is The Solemn Sentence of Death, Capital Punishment in Connecticut. It starts in, I think, 1636 and takes you through the execution of Michael Ross with a lot of stops in between. So first of all, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
And I think I do maybe just sort of want to begin. One of the things that really kind of leapt out at me, one of the things I hadn't ever really thought about in terms of Connecticut in the 1700s, and we'll sort of walk through a little bit of the chronology of this as we go. One of the things that was sort of interesting to me about Connecticut in the 1700s was there wasn't really any way to incarcerate anyone. I mean, either you put them to death or you whipped them or you put them in pillories, but there was no place to imprison anybody who'd done something wrong.
Exactly. This was pre-penitentiary.
So, talk a little bit about what the penalties were for things then.
Well, the situation in Connecticut in the 1700s, the 1600s, and 1600s specifically, was much different than it is today. Very small population, very isolated, very face-to-face, very, very communal. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that the folks who founded Connecticut, the European, the English settlers in any case, were Puritans. They saw themselves as the new Jews. This was the new Israel. This was their errand into the wilderness. So they had a utopian vision, mm-hmm. really based on the Bible. And so when they came to deal with setting up this ideal community, this city on a hill, as they called it, they went to the Hebrew Bible, particularly the book of Leviticus that had all the strictures on what happened to people who were punished. And they said, well, we're the chosen people. We're going to apply these. Mm-hmm. They applied these in the wilderness of Connecticut. So in the two colonies that existed that ultimately became Connecticut, New Haven and Hartford, the New Haven colony had some 23 capital laws. Things, for example, blasphemy, bestiality, smiting a parent, cursing a parent, et cetera, et cetera. Many of these were never applied, mm-hmm. but it was to emphasize that this was a godly community ruled by divine law, and the founders were explicit on this.
Many of them were never applied. And those that were applied, it wasn't as though they were kind of wantonly applying it, too. It seemed like the standards were pretty high. The threshold was pretty high. Often it was a requirement of two eyewitness accounts of something that typically wasn't going to be eyewitnessed.
Exactly. It's one of the paradoxes is that although they were borrowing from the book of Leviticus, which was thousands of years old, Leviticus also, as you correctly mentioned, had a two eyewitness stricture. Mm. And so that that caveat plus long tradition, centuries of English jurisprudence, meant that these Puritan founders were also very concerned with procedure.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this interesting conflict or coming together intersection of these divine laws and then all these trial procedures, which ultimately tried to be fair.
And so, I mean, on the one hand, you did have this high standard, and you had a lot of these biblically based crimes and punishments that were, some of which were just sort of never enforced. I don't think anybody was ever executed for cursing a parent.
That's right. But
people were executed for bestiality.
Yes. And there's, if I may, there's two really interesting examples here. The first white man executed in Connecticut was a man named George Spencer, 1642. And
possibly a coerced confession.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You've read very carefully and well. You should be in my classes.
Well, tell that story.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. So Spencer was a servant, a lower class white man, probably not one of the saints, one of the sinners in this very religious New Haven colony. He looked after the pigs, the swine. Mm. There was a monstrous birth, mm-hmm. A fetal abnormality that was born to a sow, had a glassy eye. He had a glassy eye. He was known to be a bit of a sinner, a bit rowdy. He was lower class. And the evidence seemed to be in an age before much embryology, you might say, mm-hmm. that he was the father.
Yeah.
And he was browbeaten, particularly by the ministers and the magistrates. So you're right. This is pre-Miranda, pre-1966. And the power of the elite really coerced his confession. He tried to recant. He recanted. They said, "We're sorry, mm-hmm. but you can't because you're obviously guilty."
No take backs.
No take backs. So they took him to the gallows on the edge of this small little community that was ultimately New Haven. They, as the book of Leviticus directed, they slaughtered the sow before his eyes, squealing and blood gushing, as one might imagine. And then they hanged him. And they said the Lord's work was done. And it was really a coerced confession.
And there really aren't obviously very many funny moments in this book, but there was a case that you talked about, a man whose unfortunate name was Hogg. And wasn't he the one where they actually brought him to the sow pen and had him like tickle the sow behind the ear? And there was...
And she became, the sow became lustful. And
yeah, there was some kind of emission that made them think that maybe they knew each other better than he said.
Exactly. And this man whose name was H-O-G-G, a very unfortunate... was also very low class. He was a swineherd, a servant, also probably one of the sinners and not one of the elite Puritan saints. Also, he apparently, interestingly, and a lot of these records are scanty, but he apparently had a hernia, mm-hmm. a rupture, and they didn't have the type of clothing that we had, and apparently his genitals, he was always... trying to support himself.
He had some kind of iron brace or something.
He had some sort of truss on, and it didn't fit well, and his pants, so breeches were always hanging down. So he was seen to be a randy person. Mm. Women testified, and actually, interestingly, a black slave woman testified against him, which is interesting in race because mm-hmm. a black woman testified against a white man, mm-hmm. although he was a lower-class white man. And they said, "You're guilty. You did this." But he had the presence of mind. It's rather remarkable, especially given what happened to George Spencer, to say, I did not. Mm-hmm. So the authorities said, "You're a damn liar, but we can't hang you because of these procedures. They're very concerned with jurisprudence." And so they whipped him 39 times, a biblical number. So he saved his life, but...
Just while we're touching upon this, and we'll come back to this, I think, a few times as we go along here. Our guest is Lawrence Goodhart. He's the author of The Solemn Sentence of Death, Capital Punishment in Connecticut. But since you're mentioning it's dangerous, I think, and to generalize too much about things, trends that you see happening over hundreds and hundreds of years of history. On the other hand, there are certain things that are kind of hard to ignore. And it does seem as though class... Mm-hmm. which you just mentioned, is an incredibly high is a high risk factor for being executed in Connecticut. That I think there have been 157 executions. Michael Ross, the most recent execution, was the only college graduate ever.
That's right. That's
and in general, it seemed as though people of below middle class are almost inevitably the people who are going to be executed.
Well, you're exactly right. That's the story of the historical record. And the people that I've identified since 1639, in which two American Indians were executed, up to Ross in 2005, with him being the exception. No college graduate. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone on the margins of society, whether it be the 11 witches that are executed in the 1600s, four women executed for infanticide, killing their infants, whether it was the five black men executed for rape out of six, whether it was the Irish immigrants, the Italian immigrants, Eastern and Southern European immigrants, there's definitely that factor. People who were, again, on the margins, a sort of underclass, very vulnerable.
And in fact, as I should mention, our phone number, if people want to call in with questions or comments as we go along here, 860-275-7266. We're talking about the history of the death sentence in Connecticut. 860-275-7266. To me, the most astonishing thing in this book, the thing that really kind of jumped out at me, was so we're looking at a history that spans almost 400 years. So within and in that 400 years, we've got 157 executions. So 60 of those executions took place within a 50-year period.
Yeah.
And that 50-year period coincides very, very closely with the confrontation of Connecticut with immigration. Can you talk a little bit about that? To me, that's the chapter that blew my mind in this book.
Yeah. That was a big surprise for me, too, when I put that together. So between 1880 and 1930, what historians tend to call the wave of new immigrants, as opposed to the famine Irish that came in a little bit earlier and other groups before that, was the number of people from Southern and Eastern Europe who were executed. And you can see, I try in the book to set the context for each one of these eras. And there was a great deal of resistance. The Irish Catholics, the famine Irish who came over, had a very difficult time, impoverished, coming into a state in which they were regarded as papists, poor, impoverished. And the same thing really happened with these Southern Eastern European immigrants. They, in effect, became the labor for the new industrial age. Poor, language problems, trying to fit into a new society. And when capital crime, when people were convicted of capital crimes, they were the ones who were focused on. And it's hard to do a entirely empirical situation because of the vast amount of evidence. But there was the large number of Italian immigrants. They were the largest immigrant group during that period, and it correlates with the number of people who were capitally executed, mostly Italian immigrants, but then also a mosaic of people from Southern and Eastern European, Czechs, Hungarians, Russians, Eastern European Jews.
Well, actually, you were able to pin down their religious affiliations, and the incredible common denominator is Roman Catholic.
Exactly.
If you were a Protestant arrestee during that period, your chances of being executed were way, way lower.
Exactly true. Exactly true. I mean, when the famine Irish came in the late 1840s, 1850s, there's a spike in the number of Roman Catholics of Irish who were killed. And that will continue on into the next wave, too. So the religious affiliation plus the lower class, the underclass affiliation, being on the margins of society, not being into it, made one vulnerable. It doesn't mean these people didn't commit murders, but it made the death penalty, as attorneys would say, more capricious, that if you fit into these factors of being Roman Catholic, of being poor and being the margins, being foreign-born, you were more likely to end up hanged.
And that was the case during this 50-year period, 1880 to 1929, where there were these 60 executions. Out of 157 total in the state, 60 of them are concentrated in this 50-year period. But if you look at the other periods, too, it does seem, though, as though whatever class, whatever group of people might have been understood to be the other of that
time.
That's
right.
So it was Indians and blacks.
Yes.
Well, anyway, I'll let you take it through. But it starts out being Indians and blacks. That's mainly who gets executed, particularly for homicides.
Exactly. in the 1600s, 17th century, it is Indians. Mm. And this is a period, the Pequot War, 1637. The English are conquering, subduing, ethnically cleansing would be the word would be used today. And in civilian trials, Indians are the ones who end up on the gallows. And then interestingly, in the 1700s, as slavery becomes more entrenched, and yet the black population is only 3% or less of the total, one of the interesting things that I found was that of the 6 men executed for rape, 5 were black from about the 1740s to the last one in 1817. So the last white, the only white man executed for rape was an itinerant. He was executed in 1693. After that, no white male was ever executed for rape. So you're exactly right. It was the other. And if I could just throw something into the 1600s, since we're back in that period, there's a clear misogyny attack on women, too, with witchcraft. And of the 11 people executed for witchcraft, 9 are women.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2 men are their husbands, guilt by association. So you're right. There's these clear patterns. And these lower-class women who were identified with witches at a time of sectarian strife problems in the church, they were the other. They were the ones who were scapegoated, agents of the devil. This is why the religious community was having problems in Hartford.
We've got a call related to that. Our number, 860-275-7266. The book is The Solemn Sentence of Death. The author is Lawrence Goodhart. It's a history of capital punishment in Connecticut. Joining us is Russell in East Hampton. Hi, Russell.
How you doing?
Okay.
Well, it was interesting. I recently read a book about Governor John Winthrop Jr. and within the context of his belief in alchemy and capitalism and all sorts of other things. But what struck me was his involvement toward the end of the witchcraft trials in Connecticut, and the fact that it seemed clear to me that he didn't believe in it at all. But it wasn't politically correct for him to come out and debunk it and say it was no good, that there was no such thing. So he sort of helped engineer the trials or massage things so that the women that were accused of witchcraft did not end up being executed. And I was just wondering if the professor could make a few comments about that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And my colleague, Walter Woodward, has last year published a great book on John Winthrop Jr. And exactly that. The last witch executed in Connecticut is 1663, and Woodward and Gershom Buckley, another minister, doctor, and a generally wise man. I think my impression is that, as you're suggesting, they believed that witchcraft was possible, but they didn't believe that these New England villagers isolated in the middle of the wilderness of New England had any sort of powers, alchemic or otherwise, mm-hmm. to summon up the devil as Faustus had done. And so they saw this as clearly what it was, a dangerous scapegoating mechanism at a time of religious strife and division in the church. That the older Samuel Stone at that time, the minister, was trying to put the community back together. So I think that's a very cogent analysis.
It seems, first of all, Connecticut wound up being America's oldest and longest-running theocracy. We didn't disestablish the Congregationalist Church until the early part of the 19th century. But in your book, you can see, in terms of attitudes towards capital punishment and corporal punishment, attitudes shifting. And it seems as you mm-hmm. get into the early part of the 18th century, the first shift happens, and it is kind of, to what degree do we really want to have the Bible as the basis for our civil and criminal law? And it seems like there's a little bit of backing away from just kind of a one-to-one correspondence with Leviticus.
Exactly. And there's that tendency over time, and I think this is the importance of a historical perspective. It may not provide the answer to these difficult issues of crime and punishment, but it does provide us some sort of platform, some sort of longer view. And I think you're right, Colin, is by the second generation of the Puritan founding, the religious fervor had died down. And so although some people, well, 11 people were executed for witchcraft, others for incest, adultery, and bestiality, these crimes by 1700 are no longer capitally enforced, although they're still on the books. And then as we move on, as Puritans become Yankees, by 1750, and partly under pressure from the British imperial government, which didn't want to favor one have one religion favored in Connecticut, all reference in the Capitol Code to biblical citations to the Book of Leviticus are dropped.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting thing, that to whatever degree colonial government didn't want to sort of attract the attention of the crown. One of the ways that you could do that would be just to be running this kind of theocratic criminal system where the British government said, what are they doing? They're killing people for what? And from there, interestingly, you go to the Enlightenment and you go to people like Thomas Jefferson, who influenced by Locke, influenced by all these thinkers. Suddenly there's really kind of maybe the first real wave of abolition sentiment in America and in Connecticut about the death penalty.
Exactly. That broad period known as the Enlightenment is a turning point. And this, to go back to one of your earlier comments, is where the idea of incarceration comes. This is an Enlightenment form, perhaps most clearly put by an Italian reformer, Cesare Beccaria, that punishment should be proportionate to the crime. And this really hit home in New England and the American colonies, particularly because 18th century England had dozens, even almost 200 capital crimes. They didn't enforce them all, but people could be hanged for stealing a loaf of bread. They clearly class-inspired punishment. And so the idea was, should Connecticut hang someone because they had been engaged in robbery? Mm-hmm. Or with the building of Newgate Prison in 1772, that person could be put into prison. And also there's a break from punishing the body in an open way, such as wearing a scarlet letter A, which for adultery, or branding someone with an M on the hand for murderer, or
you could get a B on the face. One of the guys you wrote about got a burglary thing on his face, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Or to be publicly whipped in the town square. And so now the idea was incarceration. And by the time Wethersfield State Prison is set up in 1828, the idea is penitentiary. And the Protestant idea is to be penitent, isolate the person, and have them a Bible and have them reform and remit them to society. So it's a sea change.
Although how well that's working is up to – interestingly, Timothy Dwight – I happen to be standing in Timothy Dwight College at Yale University on Saturday, so it's an odd coincidence. But I noticed that he favored upholding the death penalty for certain things and was asking also a lot of questions about whether anybody was being rehabilitated there. And then by the time the Wethersfield prison opens, this is supposed to be this new model, except that a lot of the capital cases you studied involved prisoners who'd killed their tormentors or their alleged tormentors, that what was going on in these prisons wasn't always so nice.
Exactly.
They were being whipped and humiliated and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, we want to take your phone calls, 860-275-7266. We're going to move a little bit more into the modern era as we go along here and talk a little bit about how the debates played out in the last century, the 20th century, with Lawrence Goodhart after this. All right, we're back. We're back with Lawrence Goodhart, the author of The Solemn Sentence of Death, Capital Punishment in Connecticut. Let's grab a quick call here. I want to move on to a different area here, but just staying back in the 18th century and 17th century a little bit. Here's a call from Bill in Manchester. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Colin. All right. So in Connecticut, we have the fundamental orders, and then, of course, we have the charter that comes in. And as I remember it, one of the clauses in the charter is there couldn't be any laws in the books that disagreed with the existing law in England. And I was curious to his thoughts about both the fundamental orders and if the charter makes any massive changes in capital punishment.
This is actually something that does come up in one of the cases in your book.
That's a very pertinent question because there's sort of an irony to this. Because although the British were at least nominally ruling the colonies and provided these charters, such as the Charter of 1662, the early years of the Connecticut colony and the New Haven colony, for that matter, these colonies were really isolated. You have to think it was, you know, at least a four-week one-way trip across the ocean, no cell phones, no instant communication. And so these Puritans, who the British Stuart monarchs were glad to harry out of England, were pretty much on their own. But over time, particularly as the British Empire tried to consolidate itself in the 1700s, and ultimately would lead to the American Revolution, of course, is the British became more stringent in regulating the New England colonies. And this would infect changes in the Capitol Code, particularly by 1750, in which all biblical references, the execution of witchcrafts, execution for blasphemy, all these things, a number of which were never enforced, are completely dropped from the book. It's a sea change by 1750, and it does have to do with this uneasy relation between colony and mother country. So it's a very your question is very pertinent.
I'm going to ask a question of more breadth here, and that is this, and I mentioned this in the introduction before the show, but so we have Connecticut, where we have the death penalty. Now, we're surrounded by states that don't have the death penalty. New York doesn't, Massachusetts doesn't, New Jersey doesn't, Vermont doesn't, Maine doesn't, Rhode Island doesn't. The only other state around here that has the death penalty is New Hampshire, and they basically, it's on the books. They dismantled their gallows in 1992. They don't possess the means of executing a person, right? They have one person on death row. But we're a little different. We have 10 people on death row right now. We executed Michael Ross. It appears as though we're going to execute one or two more, not to prejudice that case. And in 1960, we executed Taborsky, who we'll talk a little bit about. And so we seem to have a slightly different character than our immediate neighbors, even though we're in, I think, 34 states nationally still have the death penalty and 16 don't. But a lot of those 16 are right here and we're not. Did you develop any theories about why Connecticut is so anomalous?
It's a difficult question to answer, but it's part of the question that led me to do this research and ultimately to write the book. You're right, Connecticut is exceptional. In much of the Northeast, only Pennsylvania has an active death penalty in the whole Northeast. And the only thing that I can partly respond to that is that in the mid-1950s, particularly in the post-war period, after the Holocaust, after all the killing, UN Declaration on Human Rights 1948, the atomic bombs, the Cold War, the fear of annihilation, there was a sense that capital punishment was inherently contradictory and brutal. And Connecticut was posed. Governor Ribicoff in the mid-1950s, the Hartford Courant, and a very effective editorial page, a very effective writing was against the death penalty. Many of the legislators were against the death penalty. It seemed like it might happen. And then in the winter of 55-56, Joseph Taborsky, the so-called mad dog killer, and his mentally impaired sidekick, Arthur Coulomb, systematically, really through Taborsky's instigation, really executed six people in a series of small store robberies. And this just dragged on. Taborsky ultimately volunteers for death in 1960. But that memory stays there. And, for example, Ella Grasso, the first female governor and also a Democrat, is pro-death penalty. Mm-hmm. It just didn't seem politically very advantageous after the Taborsky murder spree for a politician to come out against the death penalty, at least a major gubernatorial candidate. And then in the early 1980s, we have the Michael Ross sexual killings of eight young women and girls, particularly in eastern Connecticut. And that dragged on. I mean, the murders were, 1982, 83. He's executed in 2005. So that's almost a 20-year period that this was there. And now we've recently heard Senator Edith Prague's characterization of Joshua Komisarjevsky in the horrible Cheshire murders in 2007. So my best answer to that is that from the mid-1950s to the present, we've had a series of high publicity, horrific murders, multiple murders that have kept this in front of the public. And if we look at the polls, particularly the very reliable Quinnipiac polls, 70-80% of the people thought that Taborsky and Ross and Hayes and Komisarjevsky should be executed, or they got what they deserved.
And it does seem, I mean, I think we're a lot like New Hampshire that way, which is that, you know, we have in place a lot of the elements that would cause a state maybe to abolish the death penalty, and we've come close, as did New Hampshire. New Hampshire in 2000, both houses passed an abolition bill, and Governor Jean Shaheen vetoed it. And similarly, you can look at certain points along the continuum in Connecticut, where, again, we get close. In 2009, you had both houses passing abolition and Rell vetoing it. And as you say, in 55, Ribicoff was prepared to sign, and they couldn't get it through the House. Now, in 2011, we've got, for the first time in a long time, a governor who has said that he is prepared to sign an abolition bill. And for some of the reasons that you just alluded to, it's not going to get through both chambers in this session. But and a lot of this does seem to be pushed by, as you say, the unhappy accident of the occasional high-profile case that just seems like an exception. Even, I mean, you have Senator Prague, who basically is a death penalty opponent, and Senator Maynard, also a death penalty opponent, who, because of, in their view, the exceptional nature of the Pettit case, are just sort of saying, not this year. And some of this just seems to be chance. It just by chance there's a Taborsky, by chance there's a Ross, by chance there's a Hayes and a Komisarjevsky, and it derails what probably might be a natural historical progress towards abolition.
I think that's true. And Prague's comments, I think, are very interesting, and Ross, too, because these were really sexual attacks. Mm-hmm. They were very misogynous. They were in attacks on women. And I'm not trying to justify Senator Prague's comments, but I think she was appalled, as everyone was, by the attacks, but really pointed at the sort of sexual nature, the violence against women that this represented. And this was sort of her pushback at this. But I think you're right. In the natural course of things, without these high-profile atrocious murders, Connecticut would have probably in the 1950s, along with many other states, and much of the Western world would have abolished capital punishment.
And it's hard to know, we were saying this off the air, what's going to create that kind of furor. I mean, there's another person on death row named Cedric Cobb, whose attack was also sexual, violent, horrifying. Mm-hmm. The death of Julia Ashe is about as horrifying a death as there could be. And yet it doesn't seem to inflame people at quite the same level. And you don't always know, you know, why that's going to be, why... as long as we're talking about sex and gender, too, you know, one of the things that doesn't get said, but there are several informal understandings that go along with the death penalty, and one of them is that women do not get executed. I forget how long it's been since.
It's fascinating. There's no statute on the book that only males can be executed. But in 1786, just to recount this briefly, because this tradition, this informal contract continues, is a girl of mixed Indian and African background, Hannah Okush, who is 12 years old, was hanged for the murder of a young white girl, a 5-year-old playmate. And there's certain resentment here, racial resentment, class resentment that Hannah took out, and she was hanged in public as that. Was a tradition up until about 1830. But that seemed to be so upsetting and so horrifying, and there's very few specific records going into detail about this, is that Connecticut never executed a female again. And if I may just briefly, you know, is in 1795, almost the same thing happens with one known as Anne Negro, because African Americans, Anne was a slave at that time, were demeaned by not having a last name. So in the court record, she was known as Anne Negro. She was also about the same age as Hannah. She also killed the white daughter, about half her age, in Pomford. But here's the difference. Anne Negro was not hanged. She was whipped. She was branded on the hand with an M for murder, and then she was sent to the Wyndham jail as it existed, really a very informal sort of thing, where she was supposed to reside for the rest of her life. And unfortunately for the historian, records after 1795 of what happened to her don't exist. But the important thing is Hannah, 12 years old, is executed in 1786. 6 years later, Anne is not executed, and no female has ever been executed in Connecticut ever since.
There are so many interesting trends that we've kind of alluded to here. We've talked about the fact that the death penalty was disproportionately applied to whatever was the racial or ethnic or socioeconomic disadvantaged class at any given moment. So it was blacks and Indians initially, then the famine Irish, then Italians and other immigrants, and as we go along here. And then another sort of parallel track to this, and it kind of leads up to our next segment here with Vicky Coward, it does seem as though the status of the victims plays some kind of role here, too. Not universal, not ironclad, but who gets killed is often as important in terms of their race, their ethnicity, their socioeconomic background as who does the killing.
Exactly. Yeah. For example, when rape was a capital crime, and that was true up until 1830, only men convicted of raping white women. There's no executions for anyone raping a black or Indian woman at all. And as far as I can remember, there's only one white man who's currently on death row, only one white man who was convicted of a capital crime for killing a non-white person.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in a drug deal in Waterbury.
Yeah.
It's in the tables in the book. So you're right, yeah. The victimology of it is very clear, and that's even more so if we look regionally in the South, mm-hmm. where it was a means of keeping black folk down, because if a black killed a white, well, then you suffered. Yeah. But if a white killed a black, there was a clear differential there.
And just as kind of a blunt instrument for that right now, I think the statistics right now are that 75% of nationally the people on death row killed white victims, whereas white victims represent only 50% of the murder victims. So 75% result in death penalties out of only a 50% population of murder victims. Sorry to throw a lot of numbers at you. We're talking right now to Lawrence Goodhart. We're going to add another voice to the conversation when we get back. His book is The Solemn Sentence of Death, Capital Punishment in Connecticut. When we come back, we're going to talk to Vicky Coward. Her son, Tyler, was murdered in New Haven in 2007. Since then, Vicky Coward has emerged as an opponent of the death penalty, and she says she hasn't always been listened to by legislators. You may have heard that story today in the news. She'll join us after this break.
Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill with help from Tucker Ives. The part of Bill Curry was played by Abe Ribicoff. On tomorrow's show, a wrenching story about human trafficking unfolds in Hartford. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, we're doing some rather serious shows, at least for today and tomorrow. And tomorrow, you may have seen the article in Vanity Fair about the human trafficking case, which kind of unfolds in Hartford and is basically broken by a task force led by a Hartford detective. You'll hear more about that tomorrow. Today, we're talking about the death penalty. I want to give out the phone number again if people want to chime in with something. 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. We're going to add to the conversation of Vicky Coward. And I first of all want to give a little shout out to the New Haven Independent. I've been following this story through there, and great reporting by Melissa Bailey and Paul Bass and some others in the New Haven Independent of a story that I think hasn't really been told that much in other places. I don't know where else you'd really be able to find out as much about it. And it's Victoria Coward is our guest right now. Her son, Tyler, was shot to death in Edgewood Park in New Haven at the age of 18 in 2007. And since since then, she's had to endure all the torments that any parent of a murder victim does. But she's come to sort of some different conclusions about this than other people do. And she's tried to get some of those ideas heard and not always successfully. So, Vicki Coward, first of all, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for agreeing to speak about what's obviously still an incredibly painful story for you. Maybe you could just begin by talking a little bit about how you felt initially after someone was arrested for the murder of your son.
Kind of shocked. You know, you really can't. It's kind of hard to describe, but
sure.
you do the best that you can, and you try to deal with day-to-day feelings. Every day is different, but you get through it with the help of God.
And at a certain point, I know just from reading the coverage, you begin to feel as though the story, at least, of your son and his murder didn't really sort of occupy the public attention the way some other stories did. It felt, I think, for you as though in some ways he seemed less important to some people than other victims.
Yeah, I did. It just so happened at the time my son was shot and killed at Edgewood Avenue Park four times to the chest, and then when he turned to run across the street, twice in the back. He was 6'5". A few weeks later, which led up to the month of July, Dr. Pettit lost his entire family, his two daughters and his wife, which was something unbelievable. I don't think the state of Connecticut has heard something like that, and especially in our county being that close to New Haven. They showed a little bit about him that night. It happened to be on the TV at the 11 o'clock news regarding my son. But then the next month, when that happened to the Pettit family, it was on every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day. So it kind of upset me. But as time went on, you just kept hearing more and more and more about it. Killings were happening and are still happening in the city of New Haven almost every day or almost every week. But you had a play, or we're coming live from whatever street, and this black person has been shot, or this person has been killed. But that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear nothing else about it.
Now, the other thing that happened is that you gradually decided or came to feel, I know that the killer of your son took a plea deal that will put him in prison for 25 years or more,
mm-hmm.
and you gradually came to feel that maybe the death penalty wouldn't have solved your problem anyway, that the death penalty wasn't quite the right answer.
It wouldn't have solved it, and it doesn't solve anybody's problem. They might feel that right now because it might have been more than one family member that had died.
Mm-hmm.
But a life is a life, and you never get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And once that person is gone, you've killed that person that killed your child or killed your entire family. You have nothing else to think about, yeah, except for you're still grieving because you don't have your family. But with me in my situation, this is the way I deal with it. Knowing that Jose is behind bars and knowing that he has to wake up every day and every night thinking about what he did to my son, that's torture right there. When you know you're on the run and you don't know when you're going to get caught in something like that, you're always looking over your back. Even in jail, you have to look over your back. You're not protected. They can do anything at any given time. So it gives me a little peace to know that he has to deal with that, you know. So that's kind of like a slow torture. I think a slow torture is better than something real quick, you know.
If I could just briefly add my sympathy first to you, Ms. Coward, for the loss of your son and your very articulate concerns. And I would just add briefly, historically, people who have opposed the death penalty from the American Revolution up to the present have really more or less articulated what you've said, that ultimately to kill the person that did the killing proves a contradiction in itself.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So you're in a long train of abolitionists in that regard, and you've put it very eloquently.
Thank you.
But I know that you went up to the state capitol to be part of a group that wanted to testify, and I know that there was one long day where I think you got there at 9 in the morning and testified at 1 a.m. the next morning or something.
Yeah.
and in general, I gather you feel as though it has been hard to be heard, and we've had the spectacle of Senators Maynard and Prague kind of recanting their opposition to the death penalty because of individual conversations with Dr. Pettit, but that you kind of don't feel as though you and others have quite the same access to tell your story.
Absolutely. A lot of people say, and I've read the comments after I did my article with the New Haven Independent, that it's not a racist, and they feel I am a racist. I'm not a racist. Mm. If I was, I wouldn't have been up there. I was the only black in the group. At that time, but there are more. But the thing is that if I did not like the way it felt when the detectives came and told me about my son was dead,
mm-hmm.
and then to know what they did to him, to shoot him with a .38 caliber, four times in the chest and then two times in the back, I deal with this every day and have to try to keep myself busy not thinking about the pain and the suffering, like Dr. Pettit, just to know he has to think about the pain and suffering of what they did to his family.
Mm-hmm.
is more than horrific. I have so much sympathy for him, and I just pray for him every day. But it's like it's not going to solve anything killing these people because you didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you're saying, well, kill him. He did this to my family. Just take him. I don't care. Hang him by whatever the legislator said. I'm like, well, God, she sounds like she's kind of violent. So maybe they need to take her off.
Well, and I guess also the other aspect of this is it seems as though so many people have been bereaved by murder, and that, you know, your story should be heard anyway as well as Dr. Pettit's. It shouldn't just be only one group of victims and one story that gets heard, and that must be very frustrating.
Yeah, it is. But I feel like if people would in the city of New Haven just step up, I don't know what they're afraid of. I don't know if they're ashamed of it, the background of the whole story coming out regarding their children. I don't know. All I know is I gave birth to a young man that was getting ready to start working at UPS the end of the week, and he got shot and killed that week. So it regardless to whatever he did as growing up as a child, it doesn't matter. That's my son. That was a life. And still, I do not want anybody to kill or murder Jose Fuentes.
Well, Victoria Coward, thank you so much for taking the time to tell your story. And it's a hard story to tell, but I do appreciate the fact that you shared with us, and I hope the rest of your day is a good day. We also thank Lawrence Goodhart. His book is The Solemn Sentence of Death, Capital Punishment in Connecticut. That's by Lawrence B. Goodhart of the University of Connecticut. Sorry to Bob from Torrington. That looks like a really interesting call. We just didn't have time to get to it. Tomorrow we will be talking about this incredible story of human sexual trafficking in Hartford. After that, we may get back to some of the other kinds of stories that we ordinarily do cover here. We will be moving up to Great Barrington, Massachusetts on Friday for a broadcast from the Berkshire International Film Festival. We'll tell you more about that as the week goes on.
Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah. She don't want the radio. She don't want the radio.
On the radio, baby. You and me talking about it.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and people call me weird now, but that weirdness got me involved in a witch trial 350 years ago. Oh, I got acquitted because I told him about the show we were going to do far in the future about how awesome the witch trials were. Suckers.